So just ask here, how many of you, this is the first time you've been in my session? Okay. And I've got conflicting advice. I know there's one thing I've learned about Holden is that there are no awkward silences here. You know, there's no problem. People do share their thoughts with you openly. That I've got conflicting advice about how much time to spend on material we've already shared. So I'm going to try to keep that as a minimum and today, and we'll try to get into the case studies as quickly as possible. Let's see, that said, it's interesting how the teaching, the first time that it was, well, first of all, let me just, for those of you who don't know me, I'll just tell you a little bit about who I am. I actually was a student at PLTS in Berkeley, and I discovered that even though Holden Village is open and welcoming to many different groups, Lutherans still seem to be at least in the majority, and I suspect that most of you are of some Lutheran background. PLTS is a Lutheran seminary down in Berkeley, part of the Graduate Theological Union. And so I started out after my undergraduate degree at Chico State places, being a seminary student at PLTS. I went there for about a year and then transferred out to Yale Divinity School. Had an opportunity to go to Yale Divinity School, and in fact was able to study under someone who's become, it seems, pretty popular both in Catholic and Lutheran circles, is Henry Nouwen. I don't know if that name means anything to you, but he was a professor there when I was there. I also had the privilege of doing a 9-month clinical pastoral education experience there. It was experimental. They did one of these and they never did it again. In our case, it was run by a Dominican nun named Mary Jenkins, and there were 5 of us YDS students who were chaplains exclusively to cancer patients in the Winchester II. So everyone we worked with died that 9-month period, and working with their families. That had a huge, profound influence in my life. I sometimes ask my students, if you had to have a year erased in your life, and it was going to be random, but you could pick one year that you did not want erased from your memory, right? Think about that. If you think about it that way, you know, what year would that be that you absolutely don't, you'd want to protect and not let anyone touch with it? Well, that was the year for me. That year at Yale Haven Hospital. I graduated from the Divinity School, and again, I don't know how you feel about your life. In my case, I feel like I just keep stumbling into, you know, just by accident, randomly stumbling into things that have led to wonderful opportunities that I just could not have imagined being coming from a cattle ranch in Northern California with parents who were not college educated, just finding, you know, myself in very strange situations. So, we had a professor there who was from Oxford University named Morris Wiles. If any of you are scientists or mathematicians, his son is Andrew Wiles, who turns out to have been on the cover of Scientific American, having discovered some mathematical solution to a mathematical problem called the Fermat problem. So, but Morris Wiles was our neighbor and did not have a means of transportation, so I took him to get groceries and things, but I also took a seminar with him and another man you may know, Lutheran George Lembeck. Then, when he realized I was applying to grad schools, he said, well, why don't you apply to Oxford? You're kidding, really? I said, did you do that? So I applied to Oxford and got in, you know, and ended up at Christ Church Oxford there. Another formative experience for me was that I decided not to go into the ministry. Decided that education would be a better fit for me. But I think that the Divinity School experience gave me a strong impetus towards service, right? To thinking in terms of my life as counters and non-counters, things that really were going to matter or not for me. I had to have a sense that what I was doing was going to have some impact, on the world. So I ended up then in a philosophy program, you know, as a department of philosophy, who would be a standard philosophy instructor, but who adopted an opportunity within my profession called public philosophy. And public philosophy is a kind of use of our training to work in the public domain to try and help to address public policy questions or to work with professions to resolve problems within certain professions. So I spent a lot of time going to conferences in healthcare professions, for example, in cases of I can't talk when I hear bagpipes. I love bagpipes. You hate them or love them? I love them.
He's going to play the bus song.
The person playing the bagpipes up on a cliff. Oh. And we were all outside, he's on a cliff, and then thing. Well, I talked about getting to it really awesome. I'm actually, despite my name, I'm half Scots, so it also probably was organic. Another formative event for me was in 1983. I lost the faith. I mean, I completely lost the faith. I don't know if any of you have had an experience like that. It just was a sudden experience. It was a deconversion experience. Christmas time, 1983. In fact, I was at the home, the country home, with Morris Wilde's family, and was walking across a commons area. And I remember it was raining and so on, and I was working and thinking, and about halfway across the commons, I realized it was gone. And it simultaneously produced a huge sense of relief, followed by a lot of anxiety. The relief was that I felt like I no longer needed to try and defend ideas and positions and beliefs that in my heart of hearts I wasn't certain of. And the anxiety was that I was going to lose every friend that was part of my life at that time. Fortunately for me, my faith, I recovered my faith, but it wasn't through theology, it was through philosophy, through two philosophers. Both of them you may know of. One is Immanuel Kant. Through Immanuel Kant's moral philosophy, this brought me back. And then an author who is a philosopher, but she writes novels, or did write novels, Iris Murdoch. I don't know if you know this name at all, but she's one of these authors where you can read about 15 pages and you'll know you'll be reading them for the rest of your life, but you'll never turn another page, right? She's very powerful writer, if you like that sort of thing. I recovered my faith in another kind of way of understanding it that has been a very forceful part of my life and thinking since. In terms of the genetic technologies, in terms of the genetics, then I originally went to Pacific to work, to do courses in philosophy of religion and in moral philosophy. I was encouraged to do more with ethics and bioethics and ended up getting involved in our health professional programs and wound up, a colleague of mine in the biology department, getting $250,000 grant from the NIH to do public outreach on genetic technologies and their impact. The 21 religious groups in Portland, Oregon. And it was out of that experience that we ended up developing programs for outreach in these subjects. Again, I don't want to repeat everything I did have done with the other groups going through. So I guess the best way to kind of frame this is the only thing that it strikes me that it's important that I do repeat is that at least show you the clip from a film called Gattaca that frames the deepest kind of moral, philosophical sorts of questions in a kind of graphic way, and then we can then dive into some other case studies. So this is for those who don't know Gattaca, I know that some of you know Gattaca quite well. A film in the mid '90s, I think. And it's about a couple, you'll see here in a moment, who have a child the natural way, the normal way that we have tended to conceive for centuries. And this kid then, through prenatal newborn screenings, which is very common now, newborn screenings. By the way, they just skyrocket in terms of the number of tests they do at the screening. And they're very hard to opt out of, by the way, these screenings. At the screening discovered that his life potential was around 30 years old. So now what this does to the couple is makes them feel guilty. that they had given themselves over to this old-fashioned way of conceiving. So they then decided to have another child and to do it the right way this time, which is to go to your local genetic counselor and doctor to have them help you assist in reproduction so that they wouldn't make the same mistakes before. And you'll see in here too that they're kind of struggling with that and wanting in some way to recapture something of the experience of reproduction that was so meaningful and important to them the first time around, right? So let's take a quick look at this this clip and then move on.
I was conceived in the Riviera, not the French Riviera, the Detroit variety. They used to say that a child conceived in love has a greater chance of happiness. They don't say that anymore. I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Early fatal potential. Life expectancy, 30.2 years. The name of the certificate? Anton?
No, Vincent Anton.
Like most other parents of their day, they were determined that their next child would be brought into the world in what has become the natural way.
Your extracted eggs, three, have been fertilized with Antonio sperm. After screening, we LF has received 2 healthy boys and 2 very healthy girls. Naturally, no critical predispositions to any major inheritable diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate. First, we may as well decide on gender. Have you given it any thought?
We would want Vincent had a brother, Thalia.
Of course you would. Hello, Vincent. You have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, bears. I've taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions, premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, and addictive susceptibility, principally violence, obesity, etc.
We didn't want, diseases, yes, but...
Right, we were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to the chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already. Your child isn't needing additional burdens. And keep in mind, this child is still you, simply the best of you. You could conceive naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result.
I don't know if you were able to follow the dialogue there. I do have a transcript, but I think we should move more towards the case studies quicker today. But just listening to that dialogue, what you are looking at here when this movie came out was certainly mostly science fiction. It was sort of predicting in the future. What we're looking at here is largely not science fiction. There still is some things in there that aren't science fiction. But with a new technology called CRISPR-Cas9, this kind of gene editing, they call it now, is possible. If it doesn't make your hair on the stand, you know, on the back of your neck stand up, I don't know what does. That it's an easy technology. It turns out it's not something difficult. James Watson, one of the five people really who put together the picture of the DNA molecule and understood it for the first time, you know, he said that he didn't believe that gene splicing and the ability to use it would occur for many, many generations. Well, he was wrong about that. What happened was that someone was working on bacteria, how bacteria develop immune systems, and how the immunity works. So what happens is that, you know, bacteria are just as susceptible to viruses as we are. Right? So, and bacteria turn out to be fairly, you know, complex organisms. So a virus will inject some material into the bacterium, and a protein that's produced by the bacterium realizes there's something new in there in the system. It then goes along the DNA of what has been inserted there, clips a little bit out, and then inserts it into the genome of the actual bacterium, so that when it reproduces, it's there again. So once it's clipped out of the virus DNA, it's inserted into the bacterium DNA, it's then reproduced when the bacteria reproduces. And that's basically, this is like, you know, with the flu shots and so on, we get, once you've got the flu, I had the virus here, I don't have to worry about getting that virus again, because my body has somehow memorized that it's there, my immune system. This is how the bacteria does it. When the scientists saw that, they said, oh my God, did you see what I saw? Do you understand what the meaning, the implications of this? The implications are, with CRISPR-Cas9, that if you can control the process, you can get this thing to clip out and insert DNA anywhere you want in any kind of genome. And guess what? In May, just this couple months ago, a group in Canada with $100,000 and mail order snippets of DNA, CRISPR-Cas9 technology kit. You can buy them. When you go home, you can go online and buy your own kit. Was able to produce something called the horsepox virus. And this is a relative of what?
Smallpox.
Smallpox. Here, for decades, scientists have been debating whether to destroy the only two known sources of smallpox virus in the world. There's only two out there. The big moral dilemma was, should we save this somewhere and risk losing the smallpox being let loose in the world again? It's all a moot point now. We can construct smallpox virus. Now, this horsepox virus replicates. It's live. It's something that can be reproduced and replicates. And another story that came out just through this same article that I'm referring to here, a young boy in the Bay Area who barely got out and graduated from high school because he was preoccupied with viruses technology and so on, and he made it through high school. And he was kicked out of a science fair experiment because he was doing genetic engineering. He then ends up as a research fellow at Stanford University doing work with CRISPR-Cas9. I would say that we're in trouble. You know, we're in deep trouble. And this story's been kind of pushed back in a way because we have so many stories and problems in to deal with right now in our world, that this story has slipped in the background here. But I don't think there's any more potentially destructive force in nature apart from nuclear technologies that have produced with the bomb and so on than this DNA. A biohazard, I think the article put it, there's only two things that could wipe out 30 million people very quickly on the planet. you know, one is an atomic, it would be an atomic war, and another would be an unleashed virus that was produced in this way. So we are in trouble. Now, if we go back then to the video here, that in terms of seeing other ways that the technology can be used, the other one in this case is to control the outcomes of human reproduction. Now, we've all always done that to some extent, just in terms of the people we select to mate with, right? I mean, there's some selection there, but it amounts to something like, you know, roulette, and in some cases with the genetics, Russian roulette, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, bad things do happen with combinations of genetic backgrounds, right? But now, you know, when you say you want to eliminate suffering, physical sort of medical induced health hazards to reduce them, to get rid of them, be careful what you ask for, because we're now at the point here that we're able to control through the editing of human embryos, you know, exactly what we're going to be getting out of them. And you might think, you know, this is way down the road, it's not going to be happening. Well, it just looks like that's not going to be the case, that it is going to be happening. Just 2 days ago, I looked in the BBC news on this, that in the UK, a commission there did an inquiry and came to the conclusion that it would be morally permissible to do research and experimentation on human embryos using CRISPR-Cas9. There we are. Right? There's the. Now, how does this impact? How is this going to affect us? And what, as people of faith, might we have to say, or how should we respond to a case like this? Now, we might say something like, "There's nothing to say." You know, that is to say, there's nothing to say. That it doesn't matter what I say. It doesn't matter what. That it's going to happen. The technology is there. People are going to use the technology, and therefore, whatever we say, whether we like it or not, it's going to happen. Therefore, we just need to find some way to live and adapt with it. That could be one response. Right? Another response, however, would be to think closely and carefully and clearly about what this technology is doing for us. You know, it would be great benefits, certainly, that could accrue to us, but also what this technology is doing to us. That is, what this technology is doing to us in a way that may, I think many of us have concerns, that it is moving us away from the very things that make us human beings, the very things that give our life meaning and value, are potentially things that are under threat because of our overuse or our misuse or our unwise use of technologies. Again, I told the other groups here, you know, about the myth of Prometheus and Prometheus stealing the fire from the gods, the first technology to give to man, and how bad this was, how bad things to give technology to people. That technologies, no matter how good, they are the sharpest two-edged swords that we can possibly think of. All we need to do is to think of the cell phones we carry around in our pocket. We had a long discussion this morning about cell phones and smartphones in the car and what's happening with distracted driving and how impossible it seems to get to solve this problem. Well, genetic technology is one of those very, very sharp, very, very sharp swords, because the sharp destructive end is really very, very serious. So now in this clip, what happens? You know, what do we see in this clip? Here is this couple. Obviously, they're a stable, you know, loving couple who are partnered and reproducing in the back of this beautiful Riviera car. You know, if you're going to conceive in a car, that's a great one to do it in. So, you know, so and it's a wonderful. We feel something when we see that picture, right? And then we see, there they are, right? And then here, what are they doing here? They're reproducing. He's got his tie on, they're looking worried, pensive. They're now under the authority of the doctor who's going to be helping them so they don't make the same mistake. And what are some of the things that were said? What do you remember from what was said that might be a concern to you?
They wanted a few things left to chance, and the doctor was like, well, no, we don't want to leave anything for chance, so.
Yeah, that was a very telling moment there, right, where he said, could you just leave a little bit to chance? It was like this pathetic last distillate, you know, of a memory of what reproduction once meant. And then, what about at the birth? What are some things you remember about the scene when he actually gave birth?
A rather impersonal listing of the maladies that this person's going to experience.
Yeah, so here's the little baby that's born. You have all of the emotional connotations of this event, and then you have the person reading out the genetic
cold water on the positive experience.
Yeah, it kind of puts a cold, in this case, an ice water, you know, on the experience, because what did they find out?
That the child wouldn't live that long.
It's not going to live.
You want to know that? As the parents, I'm surprised they'd want to know that. That's why they went there.
Pardon?
No choice.
You wouldn't want to know that.
Yeah, but in this fictional world, that was the way it happened. And this was this is an alternate world that
I mean, I remember when I had my son, you know, in Portland, and he's 17. When they did the newborn screening tests, I don't remember ever even being asked for permission to have he be tested. And in many states, religious exemptions no longer exist for these things. And the tests used to be like 5, 6, 7 tests. And look, I'm not saying that it's bad to have these tests. This is part of our discussion, right? I'm only saying that it's happening to us, something that we haven't really talked through. Because here's one person saying, of course we'd want to know. Another person saying, of course I wouldn't want to know. What is going on here? Why would we want to know or not to know in such a way that it seems so self-evident to us, but we have a different kind of perspective on it? You know, why would we? And so but as soon as they find out this knowledge, it's as though, there's this joke, maybe you won't appreciate these kind of jokes, but where girlfriend says to your boyfriend, says, so if you had the opportunity, would you like to know the time and manner of your death? And her boyfriend says, no. And then she says, well, forget it then. Okay, it's a little subtle, because there is a joke in there. There is a joke in there. Yeah. So, but to know ahead of time, like right now, all of us in this room, my case, 65 times now, I've celebrated my birthday, but I've also gone through my death date. There is a death date. There's no expiration date on my birth certificate, but there is one, right, the thing. So to know, but to, what would it mean to know those things ahead of time? Well, what did it mean in this case to know ahead of time? What was the effect of that readout, of that little drop of blood saying, with the father, the nurse saying, early fatal potential, life expectancy 30 years.
The parents were overprotective.
It's like we had a helicopter parent.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, look, let's look at the details. Again, I know the script really well, so.
The dad detaches himself right away.
What did they ask? What did they, she said 30 years, right?
The change of name.
Okay, first thing they do, is change his name. They were going to name him after Anton, who is the father. And he says, what's the name on the birth certificate? She says, Anton. Anton says, no, Vincent Anton. There's the impact of the knowledge and this attempt that we're making to control the outcomes or to adapt them. Then what happens? What does the mother say?
Oh, yeah. Okay. No. I was beyond that. Denied education, denied access to the school.
Yeah, we could there in a second.
You'll do something.
Yeah, excellent. You heard that. I was wondering if you heard enough. But the mother was saying, oh, well, you'll do something. You'll do something, you know? In other words, he's already being viewed as a disabled, someone with a disability who needs to have some special cares and empathy because he's sick. And this is what then came out when he was trying to get going to the school. And of course, no insurance. The implication there is, what isn't the pre-existing condition once you have this level of knowledge? Right? So he couldn't go to this school. And then he said, every time he falls down, people treat him like he's, right? And the psychologists have a name for this, as you probably know, labeling, right? Now, labeling is a very powerful force that if you tell a kid he's stupid long enough and hard enough, they're going to feel very stupid, and by God, they may behave like a stupid kid, you know, in the end. In other words, that knowledge led them to have an attitude and a picture and a story in their head of what it meant to have a child, right? To have this child. And that picture then it wasn't just the natural response to this, it actually constructed the relationship that they had with that child, which then constructed his own sense of identity. So we got to be careful what we're doing, and no one's talking about this at this point in time, these kinds of questions. So then, okay, what else? What else did you notice then? We can go off after the birth now, move on to the next scene, you know, where they're sitting in front of this doctor.
Yeah. She's paying a lot of attention to worrying about him.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And when the doctor, if you notice, when the doctor said, look, I understand your concern, but we have enough imperfections in the world as it is. And did you know the camera then went from her face looking down to Vincent? Mm-hmm. We have enough imperfections in the world, you know, without doing more. Now, you're a parent. Forget about whatever esoteric, philosophical arguments you might have against genetic engineering. You're a parent now, in the presence of a doctor who is asking you to make decisions now, as a parent, before your child is even implanted in the womb. You tell me how to resist that. I'm a parent, and have a probably a too robust kind of parent gene. You tell me how to resist that, right? But do you see how deep the dilemma is then for us? Because how deep do our convictions go about these things? We talked last time about Adrian Ash, a blind bioethicist that I met in Dartmouth before we did our NIH project. And she's written a lot. Her kind of distinctive path is to say, we should not be doing any prenatal genetic testing at all. That's a fairly radical kind of a statement, right? We shouldn't be doing it. And she says we shouldn't be doing any genetic testing for two reasons. One, she says, it's an affront to people with disabilities. Because the message is in prenatal, whether you agree or don't agree, this is her argument, the message in prenatal abortions based on a genetic test is that it's saying to actual other people, if we could live in a world without you, the way that you are, we would do that. In fact, we're going to work towards that. She says that you have lost something important in making that shift, however well-intentioned you might be. We've lost something important that we'll never get back, that goes straight to the heart of what it means to be a human being. So that's her first argument, and there's all kinds of literature that responds differently to that. The other one, which is less known and less looked at, is her argument is that to be involved in a genetic test in this way is to misunderstand what it means to be a parent. It destroys an essential element, a paradoxical element concerning suffering. It's what I call the paradox. She wants to say that being a parent is not eliminating the suffering, like the poem that was read last night, Jeff read a beautiful poem, that we're not out as parents to eliminate all possible suffering for our kids, and that causes us suffering as parents. We're called to go with them in their suffering, in their inevitable suffering, if they're going to live out an actually human life. Right? And we have to step back and look at our own lives and say, suffering has served that purpose in our lives. I bet you there's not a story in this room that doesn't confirm this point, that the suffering that you've gone through, some of it that you may have thought would kill you, is really the necessary experience that you had that has led you to protect what's most valuable and important to you in life, and has also given you a sense of, if not happiness, at least sort of sanguine contentedness of fulfillment that you You know which, who you are, what your commitments are, what's important, what's not important, only because you have endured suffering of a certain kind. And that this whole process then of this obsession with making every possible advantage for your kid and also eliminating all possible suffering for your kid. You remember what you said? Well, you know, okay, major illnesses, we don't want that, but can you just leave something in? Because he went on from major illnesses to what? What other things was he talking about?
Premature recalls.
Yeah, my optometrist, when I do this with optometrists, they always laugh at the myopia, you know, as being viewed as a, you know, prejudicial condition. But look, if you're a parent and you're sitting there, well, no bald, myopia, no myopia. Do you want a predisposition to alcoholism or no? Do you want... So don't, you know, sitting around the rocks here, we may think this, but if you're a parent and you're now presented, how can I say this, that to choose not to know is as morally pregnant, right, as it is to choose to know. That is, to choose not to know, knowing that you could know, produces the same kind of responsibility in you as it does to choose to know. So, like the kid said, Vincent said, I don't know what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than the local geneticist. I don't know what possessed her to do that. He's now post hoc critiquing his mother for making the decision that has led to all his trouble in life. Now he's got some of the blame, right? In the movie, he ends up taking on the identity, buys an identity of someone who's genetically engineered that allows him to then join NASA because his goal is to go on a space mission, right? So this is all about how the folks who are not engineered still can strive to force of their own energy and character to get what they want, right? All right, so then, but then finally, how does the scene end? So they're talking together, the doctor, how does the doctor persuade them, I guess?
I know best.
Yeah. Are they still a part of you? I mean, you are still the parent.
They're your perfect element that will be you.
So all,
this is the best of you.
The best of you, yeah.
Exactly. So he sees that it's clear in the clip, this guy's been through this argument 1,000 times. He knows the outcome. He knows what the resistance is going to be. He knows what the outcome is going to be. He is in charge. He knows that this is going to be, this is what's going to happen, that they're going to see this. And certainly in the end, they do, and they produce a genetically altered sibling for Vincent, right? And yeah, so he says, this is still you, it's still you. You still have your, you know, you still have your genetics in this kid. And but you could conceive 1,000 times. That's a lot of time in that Riviera. Right? You could conceive 1,000 times and never get this result. This result. And again, you know, she looks down, sees Vincent. You know, what has she done? Now, you tell me what we should do with this scenario as people of faith, this scenario. Looking down at the kid, feeling embarrassed and shamed at what they've done, that they gave in to this romantic decision. You tell me, you know, I my notepad is open here. I've got blank paper again. I'm still looking for it. Because we've gone that far, let me go. This is what we've already done. This is the scene that will illustrate this point about faith. Yes. This is the scene. You want to know what this, the you see the implication here for reproduction. What about dating? Watch this short scene here.
What is the name of this movie?
Gattaca.
Gattaca, yeah.
I see I'm not the only one who looks up every time there's a watch.
Hello, Jerome.
Hello. It's awful about the director.
Awful didn't happen sooner. Didn't the director threaten the cancer remission more than once, Jerome?
Yes, he did.
Somebody did you a favor?
Do they have any idea whose hand I should be shaking?
They found an eyelash in the south wing.
Does it have a name?
A summoned valet. Jerome?
Ken, need to pause this so you understand. This is Vincent now, okay? He's taken on a new name, Jerome. He's pretending to be genetically engineered. He's the person that they just discovered, that she doesn't know it yet, that he's an invalid, right? He's falling in love with this woman, right? What's her actress name?
Uma Thurman.
So that's what this interaction is all about. They're dating, in a sense, okay?
I just sequenced. I read your profile.
She's had you sequenced.
I'm sorry. Seems you're everything they say you are and more.
But you, Irene, you're engineered just like the rest of us.
Not quite like the rest of you. Unacceptable likelihood of heart failure. I think that's what the manual says. The only trip I'll take in space is around the sun and the satellite right here.
Well, if there's anything wrong with you, I can't see it from where I'm standing.
To this discussion about faith and technology.
Well, he's a romantic.
Yeah.
I mean, he believes in randomness, and he's not going to have the follicle DNA tested.
He's living in a generation where there's still a few people who understand what it means to say, I love you. They understand the difference between all of the characteristics that sort of are associated with your DNA and what it means to be a person. I love that concept of I love you. I don't need to know your damn genetic profile. Maybe we'll need to look at that later to do this or that, to have some reason to do that. But don't confuse my love for you with all of that. Because if you do, there is no more love. There is no more capacity for that thing that makes us distinctively human, the capacity to recognize a who inside the what of our bodies. And I'm looking around this room now, I see bodies, just like I see boxes and candles and so on. I see eyes, which seem to be important to us. Through those eyes, though, I'm in the presence of people. Has nothing to do with your body in some sense. These are people. Who's not what? Yeah, I saw.
And does she know that he's gonna die at 30?
No.
Because that adds another layer. Is he gonna do that to this woman who he loves? Is he gonna put her through something?
Why?
Hard.
Something that came to me yesterday is, what are the Jesuits thinking? And where are they talking? Because that's a branch of the faith community. It's always thought deeply about a lot of things, and they've held to some what we think are some pretty severe extremes, but they've got some great thinkers there. Where do you get to hear about them?
Yeah, you mean the science, the scientific kind, the Jesuit, some of the work that you've done in the scientific?
I don't know, because I don't know anything about them other than...
Yeah.
Daughter's school kind of thing, and they had thought through the schooling thing, and I thought, wow, they're really thinking.
Yeah, about, you know, my wife is from Guadalajara, Mexico, and when the Pope Francis was elected, the newspapers were filled with, oh, there's one of the Spanish speaking Pope, and now, you know, Pope Francis. And then a week later, the headline was, well, wait a minute, let's see, he's an Argentinian, he's a scientist. And he's a Jesuit. Oh my God, what have we done? For some reason, Argentinians in the sort of the ontology of Latin America are viewed stereotypically as having sort of more arrogance and self, you know, for some reason. and then, you know, the science and then the Jesuits, you know, all that mixed together. It's like, oh, what have we done with Pope Francis, having Pope Francis there? I think he's wonderful himself, to put away. Yeah, so, but that's the question is, what or who are doing anything about having these kind of conversations that might lead us to move more thoughtfully into the future? And I'm of the conviction, I mean, really, I don't do much anything else than that. I spend my time thinking about how to find ways to have more people who want serious conversations that aren't sort of jerked around by the damn media, you know, the crazy kind of divisive debates that lead to nothing but tribalism, nothing but loyalty to smaller and smaller groups, right? And there's a hunger for that, to really have focus like we're having focus here, to do this long enough with the right sort of, the right people who can be in positions of authority, like our pastors, you know, and our legislators, to do something that doesn't just sort of absorb this stuff again. There's some things that we can't afford to simply absorb and then wait to see what's bad with it and then try to fix it. And, you know, and again, last time I talked about the Amish, how whatever you think about their theology or the way that they live, they do have this process for protecting the community and their mission by saying, we're going to let through anything and everything that's going to promote what we are about, what we believe in. And we're going to keep everything out that is potentially a threat to that until we are convinced that it's not going to diminish us in some way. We don't have a mechanism for that in the real world. Or, you know, maybe we do it Holden. We could shut ourselves off and Holden. You know, try to make this an experimental world. So, but anyway, there's that. So let's do one case then that has to do with the genetic test here. Just go. And I think I would love to hear your opinions on it. You can talk in a small group, 20 year.
Well, it seems like it's already out of the box, so how do we stop this?
Yeah, here's where I come to and where Kant's been helpful to me in this. I have this logical fallacy that I thought about that I haven't seen before. I call it argumentum ad inexorabilum, and that happens. It happens a lot now, especially with things like smartphones. It means it's the argument from inevitability. You know, that the idea is that if you get to the place where you really think that whatever I think, it's going to happen this way, that we have a tendency to then, okay, well, let's identify with it, and then make arguments for the thing that you know is wrong because it's inevitable. You begin to make arguments for it, and maybe even identify with those arguments, right? In its most extreme form, it's called the Stockholm Syndrome. You know what that is, the Stockholm Syndrome, where you're hijacked, you maybe fall for the hijack or a kidnapping. You realize, is anyone here, this is a trigger warning moment, but have been kidnapped? The only reason I ask is I have been, very briefly. And there's nothing like that experience where you realize that you're in the presence of people who at a whim could kill, really, truly, at a whim. You have no idea whether you're going to live or die in any given moment. And your mind shuts down, you panic and so on. And one of the things that can happen is you begin to identify with your captors. So I call this argumentum ad inexorabilum because it's a fallacy. If something can't be right simply because you're afraid, it's inevitable, right? So you have to then, from my point of view, it's not, can you, as a person of faith, muster up enough hope that we're going to get through and win? It's not like that. It's that we have a duty to be hopeful. That even if we believe, for whatever reason, we believe the ship's going down, it still matters what you do on the ship. Until you don't breathe and see anymore. It matters what you're doing. And I believe there's a lot of people who are struggling right now. We're talking about this morning on the table, struggling with feeling like they've spent their lives or they're spending their lives doing stuff that's not really gotten to the nub of what it means for their life to be meaningful. They haven't gotten to it. that their jobs haven't done it, having a family hasn't done it, that they haven't quite somehow found that thing that's difficult that they have been called to do. I think one of the reasons why all of the movies that we go to that are so attractive and strong for us is that they address deep mythological themes, and one of those is that we're built to do something difficult, even if we think we will fail, and even if we may die doing it. I think that all of us have that deeply embedded in us, right? And that we still don't know how or where or how to take the steps we must take to begin taking those risks to do something difficult and important. And so how do we stop it? My notepad here, this is what I have so far, okay? And I've been talking about it a lot. But my only hope, as I see sometimes with my students, is a tenacity in trying to bring people together to pay attention to these things long enough so that we can derive enough insight to do something about it. Because we're losing a lot. I think most of us have grown up thinking that our democracy, for example, the stability of our government, law and order, you know, all of these things, that these are like parts of nature. And I think that I haven't until recently felt existentially the fragility, just how fragile what we have is, and how it really truly could go under. We don't do something different than what we're doing. Schools aren't helping, you know. Our saturation with entertainment, media, constant screens is distracting us. And all the time, all this stuff is happening. And we, those of us who spend enough time to know, to transcend, to see what's happening to us, are trying to figure out how to do something difficult and be a part the solution to these problems, yeah.
So for me, the imaging that's coming to mind is, I'm thinking of Bonhoeffer, right? Okay. In Nazi Germany, when he saw that the bicycle was in motion, and that piece of, how do I put the stick in the spoke to stop it? And the consequences then of what that was. But I'm thinking, I have a friend on this trip, and he lives in South St. Paul, and he found a place where, oh my gosh, this is a disaster, what's happening. So the city of South St. Paul has said that nobody with disability that gets any type of assistance is allowed to move into their city anymore. And this was passed by the city council. And it's something that none of us know, and Paul knows because he's deeply involved with on the city level on what's going on. And he's fighting it and going to the mayor, and the mayor's saying, but Paul, this is unanimous, we all agreed on this, nobody with assistance. And here's our argument, because, you know, we live on a hill and it's too hard for first responders to get there, and we have such a shortage on first responders. So therefore, this is a good thing and it's a right thing. And he's going, no, this is hate at the level, this is hate. And so he, his little list going back from Holden, is how his next steps in fighting this and what that looks like and who it's going to and different things. And it makes me think that's Paul finding his stick to say, uh-uh, that is not okay. And it makes me think too, just as we're in this genetic conversation and the conversation that Paul and I had last night, is that if it was a different group, if the city of South St. Paul said no more women can move in, you'd have uproar. Or if the city of St. Paul said nobody that is gay or bisexual or transgender can move in, you would see the, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul rising up and saying no, but it's disability. And everybody backs away and says, okay, yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. It's disability. And it, you know, and you're seeing this even with how we're talking about genetics. It's disability, and that's okay. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yes, another hand too.
Previous respond is my daughter. And my wife's up there somewhere. So whatever I say, you put me in jeopardy.
When you say up there, do you mean like right there.
And she has a big cane. But the problem, you talk about paradox for sure. I'm thinking of our community, our church back home. This child was born with incredible numbers of birth defects, one of which has to do with this skeletal growth, wherein he spent his first year, and it seems like maybe more than that, because there was a topic of how he's doing and all this that, you know, would come up in church all the time. At any rate, he's going to need to have constructed a whole new rib cage because it's not growing. These parts of him grow, and evidently the rib cage doesn't grow. So it will have a new encasement will have to be built every so often. So who knows how long this will go on, because if you think of Stephen Hawking, was it?
Yeah.
A physicist. He was only thought to live maybe a couple of years. He lived to be 72. Look at the contributions he made.
Right.
Okay, you watch this child, and he's a lively little guy. He's probably maybe 2 or 3 years old.
Six.
He's restricted. How old?
Six.
So, okay, 6 years old. He looks like he's 2 years old. But at any rate, he's attached to a tube, a box oxygen tank. It's about 20 feet long, and he has a caretaker there that follows him so he doesn't run out of tube. He seems he's lively, and he interacts. He could possibly be another Stephen Hawking in the making. However, there is a limited pot. There's a limited pot when it comes to how we're going to finance this. The kid's going to be probably $1 billion worth of medical attention in the course of his lifetime, if he has it.
Yeah. What's really interesting about that child that you're talking about, so I'm at a new church now, and I came from that church. And this woman approached me, and she goes, "You were at Zion." I said, "Yeah, I was." And she goes, "Do you know Christian?" That's his name. And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I'm his caretaker. I'm a nurse. And he has completely changed my life and how I view life." And the company that is supplying caretaking for him switched. She quit her job so she could switch to a new company just so she can continue on with Christian, who has given her new life. I mean, and you can look at this child and go, how much does he cost and how much is that? But how do you put a value on somebody that's life-changing and life-giving? And I think that's the discussion that we're in right now, is how can you, I mean, if you look at him and you say all of the pain and all of the suffering that he's gone through and how much he's gonna cost and the type of that puts on, but here's a child who's bringing life in an unexpected way.
And you can't deny that.
And yes. She hasn't spoken yet. Yeah.
Aren't there, those things are both true, though. That's we don't want to have a world where we just think of scarcity. On the other hand, there are limits to if 3/4 of the population each needed $1 billion of surgery, that's more than we have. So yes, stretch, but I can't help thinking that 1,000 years ago, or maybe even 200 years ago, many people in that condition would not be able to sustain life. And yes, we would grieve them, but the cost of some of this stuff is so overwhelming. And what other things, because there are limits, not anyway.
Yes, no, I understand. The dilemma is a real dilemma. And at what point do the goals of medicine sort of counter purposes to the preservation of human life in the way that we're describing here?
Yeah.
The incommensurable value of being a person. not just a body that can be repaired or not repaired or whatever it might be. Yeah, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, and then you get into the whole issue too of some people can afford medical care and some people can't.
Yeah, and then that feeds into all of the discussions about equity and equality, of starting point and equality of outcomes and all of that. So it's a very complex good question. Yes.
Oh, I was just going to add a less costly but still costly element of within the education system. How much money can be spent on children who will not receive the benefits of the education system because of public right to education. And it is a big dilemma because you have, in trying to educate the body of students that has the capacity to go on to be what you would call productive members of society. And there's no alternative in education now, or very little alternative in education now, in terms of adapting the system to serve the needs of the individuals. So that's less costly.
The stories are, I remember in our church, it was a former Quaker church when I was in high school, there was a young girl who had cystic fibrosis, mm-hmm. and she just got bluer and bluer, and she was 10 years old and very, very, and she eventually passed away as though she just wisped of, air or took her away, mm-hmm. And then the question, should this life have never been or something? You might be tempted to say, this was suffering for everybody. It was suffering for her, suffering for her family, and yet once you had anything like a connection with her, you don't ask that question.
But now we could allow that child to live if we use CRISPR. Mm-hmm. I mean, I take care of a young man who has severe hemophilia. I mean, he bleeds because he sneezes. And he is hoping and wanting a genetic cure of CRISPR because he doesn't want to live this way. And he endures what he has to endure, and he enjoys his life as much as he can. So does his family. And I don't have an answer to say genetic is better than not, but we use this to climb each step to do it one better. I've had plenty of parents who, when they found out we could have tested their children or their pregnancy, and at least let them know that they were going to have a child who died 2 weeks after it was born. And they were furious because we didn't make that available. So it now is part of the standard that it is that we just automatically do it. So to say you don't get a choice in it, there were people, very thoughtful people, who sort of said, shouldn't we offer this to everyone so that they can at least know? I think knowledge is the biggest thing. You can certainly say, I don't want to know, I don't want to have it. People do that to not have vaccines, to not wear their seatbelts, because there are plenty of people who think wearing seatbelts is really stupid until they get ejected from the car and their brain dead. Mm-hmm. It's a teeter-totter balance. There's no perfect right, there's no perfect wrong. It's terrifying.
Yeah. I thought I would like to at least have you take a quick look at this case with me, just because it raises the question of, of the use of genetics for particular sort of purposes. So this is like the use of a genetic test as the basis for an abortion. And it has an interesting twist in it, right? So let's say you're a pastor. Look here. Okay, let's go. Okay. You're a pastor, say. You've been at a church, and Roger and Sally, they're deaf. Parents of one child, age two, is also deaf. Because your church has used sign language to interpret the sermons and adult education classes many years, your parish has many deaf people in congregation. Sally has just found out she's pregnant. They are happy about this development, but are concerned about the likelihood that their next child will be deaf also. You have just attended a continuing education conference on genetic testing and know there are tests that screen for many genetic disorders that cause deafness. By the way, I would love for there to be a really robust network for continuing education purposes. you know, of all denominations. They are in positions of enormous power and influence. And I would love to see that develop more robust. Most professions have robust continuing education. But anyway, they have come to your council. You tell Roger and Sally about some of the genetic testing options and give them a business card. As they tell their story, though, you suddenly realize that they were not worried about having a deaf child, but a hearing child. They want to screen for and selectively abort any fetus which will be able to hear. In other words, they have decided they want the deaf child and are willing to go through an abortion if their fetus does not have one of the alleles that lead to deafness. You're quite stunned by this unexpected exchange and now wonder about your role in providing the means for this couple to selectively abort a healthy fetus. Now, I got this case study from someone who was fairly local in Portland, and I discovered that it's happened a number of times around the country. Let's just talk to him. How does that hit you when you hear that story? What kind of questions come to your mind rather than me force you into my questions? Yeah.
We are a faith community, and yet we are trying to deal with it without dealing with it from that faith perspective.
Yeah, I hope I can hear more from you on how that faith would respond to a case like this. This is an odd case. Again, this is not the abortion debate of the 60s and 70s, you know, but my body, myself, or the right of a woman to reproduce or not reproduce. It's not saying, this isn't about being coerced to have a baby or something. This is saying, I'm open to having a child, but I don't want this one. I don't want that one. Maybe someone over this here, maybe this group, it's got to be here. Then I'll have it. See what I'm saying is that this question, this case raises that question. And yes, in the back.
Like you say, it's true on the other foot. It takes us back to your deaf genetic or blind genetic researcher where we would want to screen out for the abnormalities, the deafness, the blindness, all of that. And everything would, we have all of our senses. And that'd be the ideal, the perfect. And suddenly, the imperfect wants to screen out the perfect. They want to retain the imperfect. And suddenly, that's offensive to us. Where for the genetic researcher, you know, she says, "Don't do genetic research because you are singling us out." And suddenly, now it's us. Mm-hmm. So it's the shoes on the other foot. And
yeah. I mean.
But are we perfect? We presume that because we hear, that makes us better.
Yeah.
Or because we see. But if you have lived your life differently, a different culture, suddenly that is your world and it's perfect for you.
Yeah, and clearly there's arguments for and against this couple having a deaf or a hearing child, right? In other words, sometimes you might hear deaf culture, the idea of a deaf culture, that deafness isn't a disability. What does disability mean? What's the difference between a trait, disability, you know? What are these differences here? And it raises that question. Yes, you have.
Well, I was just saying, I'm just baffled as to why the pastor wouldn't sit down and have a conversation with the couple beforehand and just be like, well, what are your concerns? What would be the advantages and disadvantages of having a deaf child versus a hearing child? And really thoroughly know and understand where they're coming from before you pass on the genetic testing information in the first place. Like, he or she should have gone back and, you know, communicated with these parents long
ago. So, and that also kind of implies that there's a pathway to a moral conclusion that abortion based on a genetic test for deafness is morally justifiable. Are we pretty much there, that there is or not? I don't think we're settled on that. That concept, you know. And this isn't even, you know, a test to eliminate disabilities. It's to eliminate a healthy child. To have some people, it's at least an inability, you know, an inability to hear. And we may not want to use the word disability because there's all sorts of connotations with that. But who's left out of this conversation, of course? The kid, right? So in this case, you know, this is part of the problem is that we're making decisions for people who are actually going to exist at some time and actually have opinions about things.
like Vincent, you know. What did my mother think? What was she thinking? You know?
I guess what bothered me too is that the pastor then thought, "Oh, I might be leading these couple to abort a healthy child," but really, that was a healthy child regardless. If all you're talking about is deafness, you know, to me, a deaf person is still healthy.
It was a genetically normal child by our standards. We don't know it's a perfectly healthy child, and it's a fetus. It's not a child.
Yeah.
And so the question is really, they want to eliminate this particular trait, but there are so many things that can happen before a child is born. So it's like we're presuming everything's going to go perfectly and that we'll have a healthy child. You don't know that.
You don't know that, but in a case like this, would you think differently about it if they were selecting for blindness, say? Do you feel differently about blindness than you would deafness? In other words, is deafness on a continuum disability where you might accept deafness but not blindness?
Yeah.
Right? See, the technology's produced these dilemmas for us, yeah. Yeah.
Well, isn't this whole thing about the parents and what they perceive to be the future relationship?
Oh, yeah, for them, the argument is pretty clear that they don't feel, that, you know, they would say things like, "I don't feel competent to be able to handle a hearing
child." I think when you said deaf culture, I mean, I've known some deaf people, and I think there definitely is a culture.
Uh-huh.
They want their child to be part of the culture.
Yeah, okay.
And that's relationship.
And they would say things like, you know, having a hearing child would exclude that hearing child from being able to participate in this deaf culture. Whether that's true or not, that's the things that you do here. Okay? And that if you don't have hearing, it does attenuate your other senses in a way so that there is an experience that deaf people have that we're not capable of because we do hear. Right? So there's arguments there, but I wanted to focus, you know, just to focus on the concept of having a genetic test as a basis for making a decision about whether or not to have an abortion.
And they're still going to have that possibility of having grandchildren or something that can hear, because those non-hearing children may may choose to have a hearing child, so they're still going to possibly have this situation come back to them.
Yes, I can hear you, but I can't see
you. Disembodied voice.
Disembodied voice.
Sure.
Yes.
One thing that struck me from that you could rewrite that case, but when thinking about the other and some of the other classes, you could rewrite that case with two people of color not wanting to have a child that could pass.
Right.
And it would feel real different, but it would be there would be some real similarities to it also.
No, I understand what you're saying.
And it takes the cultural part is really front and center in that case.
Yeah.
And I had a hearing friend who taught for quite a few years at Gallaudet University, which is a university for deaf people.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, they made a decision that all hearing faculty needed to leave.
Hmm.
And only, you know, and so there is that there, I think there truly is a deaf culture and a, that you are either part of or you are not, no matter how much you try to be.
Yeah.
So.
Do you see that as a good or a bad thing, or are you just reporting your answer?
Yeah. I'm reporting that it was a thing.
Right.
And, so I feel it as a little bit of bad because it impacted my friend.
Right.
But I kind of, she too, I mean, she understood where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was reporting.
Right, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yes, come back.
The thought I have is that more and more of these decisions will be made by people who are not part of a faith community. Yeah. Or given what I perceive as demographic of this community, made by people in faith communities who have ideas that are far divergent from our own. And that complicates the whole thing in terms of where does the culture or cultures of this country go.
Right. Well, that's a good place. I mean, I think that that's a good place for us to wind up, you know, the land here for the today, is that I think that many of us, me included, have felt for a long time like Gulliver, you know, in Gulliver's Travels, where he somehow wakes up in life, like Dante in the middle of his life in a wood, and he realizes he's lived half his life and he doesn't know crap. He doesn't know anything about anything. He thought he did, but he doesn't. Doesn't know nothing about nothing. But Gulliver wakes up and he realizes that he wants to move, but he's got these tiny little threads around him, like Lilliputians, you know, strapping them down, none of which are strong at all. They're all small little tiny threads that are holding him down, making him immobile. He can't get up. I think many of us feel that way, that somehow we see enough, we're awake enough to know that something's wrong and something has to change, and I am somehow in the middle of this in a way that's important. I'm not a trivial presence in the world. I'm not a piece of nature. I'm not just a piece of nature. I'm not just a thing, I'm a who. And therefore, I need to find out what my Luke Skywalker moment is, what it is that I'm gonna do that may cost me my life even, that's important enough for me to give the rest of my life to. And then take a problem that you think is one of the problems that is killing us, and I think there's five or six of them now that you can easily select, to at least attempt to do something hard to change things so that it doesn't undo us. You know, that's all. That's really, again, all I have to think about. That's all I think about anymore. I don't want to end up with my tombstone. You know, watched a lot of great Netflix series or whatever it is. You know. Really had a good time at Holden or whatever, you know. I really feel like we're in an age of time, maybe it's just a function of being in my 60s that you think these things, but, you know, I think we're in an age and a time where we're called to be doing something really different, and it's got to be something very decisive, and it's something dangerous, right? And it's something definite, you know, to look for that and to plant the flag and move forward with it. Find people like yourselves here together to support yourself. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.